The Gopher Legislative Advisory Board was created by Executive Order 2020-06. That order is publicly available on the governor's website. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the board, is open to the public, and will be run in a manner compliant with New Hampshire RSA 91-A. We are taking minutes, which will be posted to the Gopher webpage. As we've said, today's meeting is also being recorded. Should you be a speaking participant and not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect now or at any time. My name is Jerry Little. I am Director of the Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery, and I will facilitate today's meeting. Because the board is meeting by phone, under RSA 91A, there are a few initial logistics that we need to establish. First, each of us must state our names, where we are located, and who is in the room with us. We'll do this by roll call. I am Jerry Little, Director of the Gopher, in the Gopher office at One Eagle Square in Concord, and in the room with me is Rhonda Hensley. Senate President Donna Soucy, are you with us? Senator Soucy. If you're on, Senator Soucy, if you could hit 5-star to unmute your line. We'll move along. House Speaker Steve Shurtleff.
Thank you, Commissioner. Steve Shurtleff. I'm at my residence in Penacook, and I am alone.
Republican Leader Chuck Morse.
Chuck Morse. I'm at my office in Atkinson, and I'm alone.
House Republican Leader Dick Hinch.
Dick Hinch. I'm in my office in Merrimack, and I am alone.
Senator Lou D'Alessandro.
This is Senator Lou D'Alessandro. I'm in my home in Manchester, and I'm all alone.
Thank you, Senator. Chairwoman Mary Jane Wallner.
Mary Jane Wallner. I'm at my home in Concord, and I am alone.
Senator John Reagan.
John Reagan, I'm in my home office alone.
And Representative Aaron Hennessy.
Aaron Hennessy, I'm at my home in Littleton, and my two minor children are in the house with me.
And Senate President Donna Soucy.
I am here on the line. I am at my home in Manchester, and I am alone.
Thank you very much. As we move through our agenda today, each board member and anyone else speaking is asked to identify themselves before speaking. Should you choose to take any votes today, they must be done by the roll call process we just used. And finally, before we begin today's presentations, please remember to hit 5-star if you would like to ask a question. Also, presenters are asked to hit 5-star when their turn comes up, as that allows us to unmute your phones. And last Tuesday, Gopher circulated the updated cover letter from Senate President Soucy and Senator Morse, which you all approved. That letter, as well as your proposed allocation, was then sent to the governor's office. Today we will be hearing presentations on housing and homelessness. We're going to start with Dean Christen from the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. Dean, are you with us?
I am here. I am here, Director Little.
Thank you very much, Dean. Why don't you kick off our presentations, please?
So thank you, and thank you, everyone, for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. Director Little asked me to summarize some of the comments that were provided to the Stakeholder Advisory Board around housing-related issues about a week and a half ago. And just for a quick background on that, that board, as you know, has been in a parallel manner collecting information for Gopher in the governor's office using a questionnaire that asks the same questions basically of everyone who wants to submit information. The chair of that body, Donnelly Lozo, asked me to circulate that questionnaire broadly amongst housing stakeholders and try to generate some information from them. We did, in fact, do that. We received written comments from about 24 different individuals and organizations, as well as some oral comments from people. It involved individuals who are housing developers, property managers, property owners, service providers, lenders, realtors, a broad range of entities and organizations. And we synthesized that down into a memo that we provided to the stakeholder advisory board about a week and a half ago. The information that I have provided, I hope, to you last week is very similar to that. It is a little tighter, if you will, and a little more summarized further as we have learned a little more about critical needs. The three most critical areas I think we heard about, all of which involve response to and relief from issues that have been generated as a result of the pandemic in the housing space, begin with the issue of rent stabilization. And the concern here is that as the unemployment rate has increased, as many people have found themselves suddenly unemployed, there is concern about the ability of many individuals to pay rent. And this is exacerbated by the fact that many of the employment areas that have been hardest hit by this surge in unemployment involve individuals in the service sector, in the retail sector, and in other sectors of our economy where data suggests a larger percentage of people tend to be renters. They also tend to be somewhat lower wage earners. And so the concern, not just in New Hampshire, but nationally, is that as the effects of the sort of short-term stimulus payments and perhaps the extended period of extra unemployment benefits begin to dissipate, that we'll see a real significant difficulty for people to pay rent. We've already heard from property owners that rent delinquencies are up significantly. We've heard numbers ranging from 10 to 30%. And there is a significant concern, not just here, but nationally, that these numbers will continue to grow as we get further into this. When I say national concern, I will note that the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard, for instance, published a report a couple of weeks ago that identifies this as one of the most critical issues that they think might be facing the state and the housing sector, the nation and the housing sector over the next few months. So one of the major concerns that has been expressed is that as we move through this period, that people will have difficulty paying rent. That has impact on their housing security. It has impact on the property owners who will not have the revenue that they need to meet their obligations to their lenders, to pay property taxes to communities, to pay utility bills. Ultimately, when the eviction moratorium is lifted, it is likely that that will generate a significant number of eviction activities, which will also have an impact on the court system. And so one of the suggestions that came forward was that some of the CARES Act money could be invested in providing short-term emergency rental assistance to individuals who, or on behalf of individuals who lost income, lost jobs as a result of pandemic-related matters. The concept here is that any such program would be focused on those individuals and would make payments directly to property owners on behalf of those renters for some period of time in the 3 to 6 month range that would ensure that those negative consequences that I alluded to earlier do not, in fact, occur. And I think that's the first issue. Obviously, that in order to be effective and to have significant impact and to serve a lot of people, this would require an investment of a not insubstantial amount of money. And there are ranges of estimates of how much might be necessary to have real impact, $25 million at the low end to $100 million at the high end, we have heard from people. I'm not sure anyone really knows exactly, but whatever amount was allocated here would have to be significant in order to ensure that we didn't raise expectations unnecessarily. The network that we would propose to use to do this in the event that it was something that policymakers wanted to move forward with would be an expansion of efforts already undertaken by the community action agencies that do some much more limited work in the area of emergency housing support, and we believe that a program could be built on that infrastructure relatively quickly that would move forward and actually be able to serve a significant number of individuals going forward. The second area that was identified is related, and it goes to the issue of homeowners who might be at risk of foreclosure as a result of loss of income from the pandemic. Now, here there is a different dynamic because a significant number of those individuals are likely to have mortgages that are connected to the federal government. And as you probably know, the CARES Act provided some protections for individuals with federally supported mortgages, and basically providing that they can ask for mortgage forbearance or basically deferral of their mortgage payments for a significant period of time. But a couple of observations were brought forward there. First, forbearance is not forgiveness, and so it means that at some point those payments are going to have to be made in some manner. And while there's not the suggestion that perhaps resources need to be devoted to helping to make those payments directly, the concern is that people need to understand what their obligations and opportunities are. And one of the things we've learned from the not that long ago experience of the Great Recession was that when people are faced with challenges paying their mortgages, one of the things that's very important is for them to have access to independent professional counseling support. And so one of the suggestions that came forward from the community was that we essentially rebuild, rejuvenate a program that had been in place for a number of years during the Great Recession known as Home Help NH, which was a partnership between the banking department, the Justice Department, and New Hampshire Housing at the time to provide foreclosure counseling related services to people across the state. Ancillary to that, it has also been recommended that some resources be set aside to actually provide direct assistance for individuals who are not going to have the benefit of federal protections. And so we estimate that about 30 to 35% of all of the homeowners who have mortgages in the state, and that could be as many as 80,000 households, are not covered by the federal protections. And while we've learned from talking to our friends in the banking community that most New Hampshire-based banks and servicers are providing very similar protections to their clients as the federal government is requiring for federally supported mortgages, not all services across the country are obligated to do that. And so many New Hampshire homeowners who have difficulty paying their mortgage might have significant financial burdens as a result of this situation. It is particularly true that individuals who have manufactured homes that have mortgages are not likely to have federal protection, since very few of those properties are actually eligible for federally supported mortgages. And so in addition to the counseling component, it is suggested that some dollars be allocated to a program that could be used to provide direct assistance to home buyers where no other option is available to keep them from foreclosure. And again, the purpose here is not only to help them as individuals, but also, frankly, to avoid the negative implications that come to communities, to neighborhoods, and frankly, to the overall real estate market from a significant uptick in foreclosures. And then the last area that was brought to our attention involves homeless shelters. And obviously, those of you who have had the opportunity to see a shelter in operation know that they are not designed, frankly, for social distancing. They tend to be very tight spaces when particularly during periods of maximum demand during the winter months. And so those providers have worked very hard in the last few months to try to maximize the number of people they serve while at the same time protecting them with social and physical distancing. And it's led to some extraordinary measures, including, as you know, the sort of development of tent cities in a couple of places. Others have acquired on a short-term basis other facilities. They're using more staff. They're spending a lot more money on different approaches. So there's been both an operating cost impact and they're looking ahead and looking to the fact that in the long term, ultimately, there will be a need to fundamentally restructure how these facilities are designed and operated. And that could include physical plant changes inside existing buildings, the addition of new space, and other accommodations that are designed to make sure that as we go back into the winter months in particular, that there's an opportunity here to shelter people in an emergency situation appropriately and safely. So that in that particular area, the ask involves additional operating resources. Some of those have already been provided through the Department of Health and Human Services, but they're basically putting on the table that they're going to need more of those resources, and also the suggestion that some dollars be allocated to a capital fund, essentially, that could be used to help with these physical plant improvements going forward. I think those are the three core areas. from our perspective at New Hampshire Housing, we've identified where we believe we could be of assistance in any of these three areas should it be determined that it's appropriate to move forward. We're happy to stand to step up and do some work here if that is desired. I'm also happy to try to answer questions about any of these issues if you have any.
Thank you very much, Dean. Do the members of the committee have any questions for Mr. Crispin? I don't. Senator Morse, you have a question, sir. Senator Morse, star five, maybe? Unmute your phone. Or how about Senator Susie? Do you have a question?
Yes, I did. And it was specific to manufactured housing. I wanted to make sure I understood what the request was and how we might be able to assist people in manufactured housing since their circumstances are so unique.
Thank you for the question, Senator. There are two components here. First, they would obviously be eligible for the housing counseling support that would be available to anyone really across the state who has questions or issues related to their ability to pay their mortgage. But I think with specific regard to manufactured housing, because so few manufactured homes are eligible for federally related mortgage assistance, it means that the bulk of people that have a mortgage on a manufactured property are not likely to be eligible for long-term federal forbearance and other types of supports. And so it is likely that the funds that we're suggesting be allocated to a direct assistance program would be skewed to a degree towards manufactured homeowners in the sense that they're not likely to have access to other resources. So that money might be used to help them pay some portion of an arrearage if it comes down to the fact that that's what stands between keeping them in the home and not. We would suggest that that be done in some form of a deferred payment loan structure so that you know that people, frankly, need the assistance and that ultimately they have an obligation to repay it, but maybe they don't have the capacity to do it right now and you avoid any dislocation in their housing situation. But manufactured housing does, in fact, pose a unique challenge and probably an accelerated risk in this environment relative to other types of housing.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Crispin? I don't see any on the board or hear any. So, Dean, were you planning on introducing Ms. Margolin next?
I didn't know how you wanted to do that, but I'm happy to do that, Jerry. So one of the other speakers that joined the stakeholder advisory board a week or so ago was Alyssa Margolin. Alyssa is the director of Housing Action New Hampshire, and in addition to dealing with a broad range of issues, has been very engaged with her team in doing some work with the shelter providers, I know, and has provided a lot of important information to the Department of Health and Human Services and to us about the needs of that particular community. And I believe Alyssa also provided some written comments and is available to speak to the board.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Director Little. Thank you, Dean. Thank you, Chairman Morse, and members of the Legislative Advisory Board. I sincerely appreciate you dedicating this meeting to understanding the impact of the pandemic on housing and homeless services. As Dean said, my name is Alyssa Margolin. I serve as Director of Housing Action New Hampshire. We're a statewide coalition of 80 organizations focused on improving state and federal policy so everyone in the Granite State has a place to call home. Our membership includes affordable housing providers, so organizations you're likely familiar with like NeighborWorks of Southern New Hampshire, AHEAD, Catch Neighborhood Housing, but also private developers and property managers like Great Bridge Properties, Stewart Property Management. We also count among our members the state's public housing agencies and our homeless services, including transitional shelters and emergency shelter providers, as well as supportive housing providers. We've obviously been in very close communication with our members since the pandemic hit, and we've done some surveys, and we hold weekly Zoom meetings that are specifically focused on the impacts of COVID-19. We've been coming together to listen and learn, identify needs, share resources, form key partnerships, and seek solutions. The last 8 weeks have really taught us that the challenges of this pandemic are multifaceted, and in a way they've been impacting various subsectors within our membership a little differently. For example, for our members who provide traditional workforce housing, they're reporting very similar stories you just heard Dean articulate about, you know, tenants who've been really hard hit by COVID-related job loss, thus impacting their tenants' ability to pay rent. We've also heard anecdotes about, you know, property managers who have become makeshift social workers. They have found themselves helping tenants advocate for unemployment, connecting their tenants to food banks, and they're also, you know, doing a really good job working out payment plans where they can. And early interventions like the stimulus check were really helpful in getting through April. I think the scariest time for our state's rental market is really just around the corner. But for our shelter providers, the scariest times were pretty immediate. There's no safe place, as Dean just said, to isolate or quarantine within a traditional emergency shelter. So in order to keep shelter residents safe, homeless organizations and the incredible people who lead them, they had to actually locate, open, staff, and manage new sites in order to what we've been calling decompress their crowded shelters or kind of lower the census and the crowding. We worked with the state to provide isolation and quarantine needs to those exposed, symptomatic, or diagnosed. And all of them had to totally recreate meal planning and meal distribution because their volunteer-based soup kitchen model really quickly fell apart. I have submitted written testimony and includes a number of proposals. I'd like to focus my time with you today on two of them, rent stabilization needs and homeless shelter adaptation needs. I have listened closely to your prior convenings. I really do appreciate your deliberations on the best ways to distribute these CARES Act relief resources. And as you have noted in prior discussions, you know, some issues are just foundational to everything else. And housing is definitely one of those foundational issues. You can't rebuild an economy if your housing market is unstable. You can't implement good public health policy if housing is unstable. And you can't provide education if housing is unstable, and you can insert a lot of things there, and you really get to appreciate why housing is so foundational to everything else. And that's why we are concerned with stabilizing the affordable rental market. I think it's been noted recently in both local and national press that we are unfortunately on the brink of an evictions crisis. And for us here in New Hampshire, the pandemic hit at a time when our rental market was already strained. Our lack of affordable supply created a market of what we call cost burden tenants, you know, essentially people who pay more than half of their monthly income on rental costs. So we already had this vulnerability in the market before the pandemic hit. And now we've added some severe loss of jobs, particularly in sectors like hospitality and retail. And the result is, unfortunately, a growing number of renters who lack the ability to pay. I've described this in some places as the perfect storm. Others have called it the upcoming eviction tsunami. I'm going to stick to perfect storm. I really view this as the coming together of a number of concerns. I mentioned the cost burden renters with additional economic hardship, the lack of housing supply and just other options, and then you have a growing number of renters who may find themselves very soon owing several months of back rent, which is really hard to overcome. And then you almost have a pent-up demand for evictions from some property owners as we approach the expiration of the moratorium on eviction. We do not view this as a tenants versus landlords issue. Although the moratorium may have frustrated some property owners, it did create much needed stability in the interest of public health. You know, the big picture that we're asking you to help us address is more about the system, you know, a system where both parties, landlords and tenants, really rely on each other. Rents pay mortgages, capital maintenance, property taxes. We've all heard the expression too big to fail. In many ways, our housing market is too essential to fail and really needs your help. So this is why our proposal includes the request for this rental stabilization fund that Dean described, to provide short-term rental assistance to really fortify a weakened system and to get our rental market on solid ground again. But I'd like to use the remainder of my time to raise the concerns about our state's homeless shelter system, particularly our emergency congregate living shelters. You know, the bottom line is that we just can't go back to crowding people in bunk beds 2 feet apart. And we do need to make major changes in how we provide emergency shelter. You know, to date, with the support from philanthropy, the governor's office, the EOC, DHHS, you know, homeless organizations have just done tremendous things to keep people safe. They've, you know, as I noted, the regional decompression of the population. We've launched new health partnerships, found places for isolation quarantine, but we unfortunately have seen, you know, outdoor encampments grow, and that is really concerning. Where do you go when you know you can't go back to the way things were? If you've ever toured a shelter, you know that they're really just rooms crowded with bunk beds. So that's why we've come together to propose this shelter adaptation program to make the needed changes to the physical spaces and the operations to support new on-site health protocols and safe social distancing measures. There are just some infrastructure needs that we can't ignore anymore. And you know, for some shelters, that would be a new laundry area or a bathroom facility. Many shelters now need to restructure their cafeterias. They were kind of crowded, long tables. They probably need, you know, smaller tables spaced further apart. A lot of shelters are talking about the need to add new entrances and redirect flow. So you have one-way hallways, IT needs for video monitoring and that kind of thing. But we also need this to address the encampments, and we do that through outreach workers. You have to rebuild trust and get people sheltered and safely housed as soon as possible. Based on weekly calls with our full statewide shelter system, we anticipate that there's about 75% of our state's 46 shelters need some kind of infrastructure improvements. Our shelters have also lost a lot of their volunteers, so we need to make sure they have the staffing they need. And it makes sense wherever possible to move people out of shelter and into housing with evidence-based supportive services. I'll close with our thanks. Many of you have been part of our efforts over the years to address New Hampshire's lack of affordable housing, and you know, we were on our way to making great progress. The number of projects in the pipeline were impressive. And last year, our homeless numbers in our state were actually down. But with the necessary stabilization of our rental markets, needed improvements to our shelter system, I think we could avoid an unraveling and bridge us to a more hopeful future. And thank you again for this opportunity, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Margolin. Questions? Representative Mary Jane Walnut.
Thank you, and thank you for the information. I was wondering, first of all, how many shelters are there in the state, and what is the present capacity?
So our state has 46 shelters. Some of those are emergency shelters. Some of those are transitional shelters, and every shelter is a little bit different. We have, I don't have the number for you, our total number of beds in the state. Can certainly get that number and provide it to the Legislative Advisory Board. Our two largest shelters in the state are in Manchester and Portsmouth. Manchester at about 138 beds, so that would be New Horizons, and Crossroads at 120 beds. Due to decompression and some folks leaving shelters, the census is down because shelters were not taking new intakes. This is the tension between providing health and safety for the residents you're currently sheltering and a difficult decision to not take in new folks into shelter who need it. So there's been a challenge here, and one of the reasons I think that we really need to rethink our whole emergency shelter system is we need to come up with safe ways to do new intake so we can provide emergency shelters when it's needed.
Senator D'Alessandro.
Thank you, Chairman Liu. A question, Elsie. The number of people who are in the camps that you mentioned, I know that the number in Manchester is growing quite dramatically, and I've seen the camps in Concord, but the number of homeless people who are now sheltering in tents up along the riverbank and in other parts of the city of Manchester and the state. What's the number of people involved? What's your best count? And how could those people be served as we go forward?
Thank you for the question, Senator. It is concerning. I think our state over the years has done a wonderful job of really keeping encampments to a minimum. And then I think municipalities during this crisis have really stepped up. You know, CDC advised that we bring portable toilets, meal delivery services, portable showers, hand washing stations to encampments and not disturb encampments. And then in addition to that, some shelter residents became really nervous in the pandemic and left shelter and went to seek encampments. Again, municipalities have been wonderful partners, but they're really not going to tolerate this very long, and we need a more humane solution, you know, for the people who are living there, for the people who are serving, and for the in the best interests of all of our towns and cities. In order to reverse course, you're going to need outreach workers, and these are essentially folks who go and build trust in the community and bring folks either back into shelter or back into support housing first with services in order to be successful. What we don't want to do is, you know, have a situation where we just pull all those services away and then just have folks kind of wandering around. This is really an opportunity to do things better. But we really don't have a lot of outreach teams in our state. So our hope is that part of this program would be to shore up some outreach so we can transition these camps to more humane solutions.
Any further questions?
I just
questions?
Also want to say to Representative Wallner, I have come across there, I have the sheet from DHHS on all of the 46 shelters and the number of beds next to each, the name of each shelter, so I'll go ahead and send that to the Legislative Advisory Board.
Thank you, Ms. Margolin, and we will distribute it out. Our next question is from Mary Jane Wallner. Representative Wallner.
Thank you, and I appreciate you finding that information. So as you're talking about the shelters, you're talking about developing spaces that can be, people can be in further distance. It seems to me that means that there will actually be less capacity unless we increase the number of shelter facilities, or unless maybe some facilities have enough space, but it seems like if we're going to be increasing the amount of square footage per person, it's going to mean that each of our shelters might have less capacity. And have you factored that into this request, that we would maybe need additional space?
Yes, I think that's a very accurate observation. The number of beds per shelter is likely to change if we really want to stick to 6-foot distancing and no more bunking. So in some cases, shelters are talking about continuing relationships they have around decompression. So on the seacoast, they have a long-term lease arrangement with a hotel now and need support to keep that lease going. In Manchester, they've opened up additional space, essentially having to open a shelter next door to deal with the space needs. So in, you know, some places might need an entirely new wing, a second floor. I think that those would be the larger shelters, and so a big infrastructure problem like that, there'd probably be just a handful of them around the state. But they're really a push to get folks into housing solutions would be the preferred approach wherever possible, and this really is an opportunity to do that.
And have you that's been factored into your request that you I just received some materials that you were requesting for the homeless shelter at program. You were requesting $25 million. Is that correct?
Yes, and we talked to our shelter members, particularly the large shelters, and asked how they would approach this exact issue that you've named when you're when having fewer beds. And obviously, you know, the state has an interest in making sure that we could at least sustain the number of beds we had available in the state. And some of them already had done some planning on shelter improvements that they could implement, like New Horizons, for example. I think other shelters like, Concord Coalition and Homelessness that runs a winter shelter is really going to be able to only take half of the residents that they had last winter. So it's going to have to work in partnership with the other shelters like the McKenna Health, Salvation Army, and the Friends Program in order to come up with a space solution for sheltering Concord area homeless residents, particularly in the winter.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Margolin? I don't see any, so thank you very much, Alyssa.
Thank you.
Our final presentation this afternoon is from Sarah Mattson-Dustin, who is Executive Director of New Hampshire Legal Assistance. Good afternoon, Sarah.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much, Director Little. Good afternoon to the chairs and the members of the advisory board. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. My name is Sarah Mattson-Dustin. I'm the Executive Director at New Hampshire Legal Assistance. We're a nonprofit law firm, and we provide civil legal aid here in New Hampshire. I know many of you are familiar with our work. NHLA is part of the civil justice system. So unlike in the criminal justice system, there is no right to have an attorney appointed in most civil cases. And at NHLA, we help people with civil cases that impact their most basic needs, things like safety, shelter, economic security. We work exclusively with low-income people and people age 60 and over. Many of our clients are experiencing deep poverty. 43% are at or below the poverty level, which for context is a bit more than $500 per week for a family of four. Many of our clients have other vulnerabilities. For example, more than half experience disabilities, and over 40% have minor children. We work all around the state. Our offices are in Berlin, Claremont, Concord, Manchester, and Portsmouth. And last year, we traveled about 100,000 miles to reach our clients where they are in every corner of the state. I'm really happy to be able to tell the advisory board that we've been able to maintain near total operational continuity during the state of emergency. We're continuing to receive new requests for legal services, continuing to take new cases, continuing to represent our clients, including in new forms like telephonic hearings. And we feel pretty strongly that we're in the calm before the storm right now. I think Alyssa described it really well when she talked about the housing crisis being around the corner. So I want to be abundantly clear that civil legal aid, both here in New Hampshire and everywhere else in the country, has never had enough capacity to meet demand. So when I talk about a surge in need coming, I'm really talking about exacerbating a shortage that is acute in the best of times, and there absolutely is a surge on the way. Based on the last recession, we are expecting that the number of people who are eligible for our services will increase by as much as 20 to 25%. I know you want to focus on housing today, so I'll zero in on that as well. Housing is our largest practice area at NHLA. It makes up about 40% of our cases overall. And as was described to you, moratoriums on eviction and foreclosure are staving off housing crises right now, but families remain obligated to pay their bills. And as New Hampshire begins to reopen and the moratoriums are lifted, many families are going to be left with significant arrearages and the threat of imminent homelessness. We have an incredibly low vacancy rate in rental housing here in New Hampshire. What that means for our low-income clients is that rehousing can be near impossible, even if folks are able to pull together a large payment of first month's rent and a security deposit. There may simply not be an apartment that's available. We 100% support rent stabilization, housing counseling, support for shelter providers as been described today. We know those will be essential efforts and we are behind all of them. The civil legal aid that we provide is also going to be on the front line of these economic relief efforts. In New Hampshire's housing environment and certainly in this public health environment, we really don't want a single family to be wrongfully evicted. And that's what we do. At NHLA. We make sure that evictions and foreclosures move forward on lawful, substantive, and procedural grounds. Often that's not through litigation. That's through helping tenants work out reasonable agreements with their landlords. That's through making sure that a homeowner is able to enforce the provisions in the CARES Act that provide certain relief related to mortgage payments. Housing First is a mantra that we hear now across human services disciplines. It's the literal and figurative foundation of stability for families, and that's why it's always been an absolute top priority for us. So we know that this need for civil legal aid and housing is going to surge. It's not the only need that's going to surge. I outlined our projections in my written testimony, and I hope you'll indulge me to just highlight one other area orally. Our second biggest practice area is domestic violence. We help domestic violence survivors get protective orders. These are the orders that require an abuser to stay away from the person they victimized. We also help survivors get divorced, get child support, get orders related to custody and visitation. And we just recently got the data about the number of protective order cases that were filed in April of this year, and it was the lowest since January of 2019 after what had been a fairly steady upward trend. That's really scary to me because we know right now many people are just not in a position to be able to access resources safely. And as the state begins to open back up, I think we'll see the need for legal representation in domestic violence cases go back up dramatically. And we need to make sure that people are able to confront those circumstances with a legal advocate alongside. What we do in our work is really help people solve problems, help families get back on the path to stability, and often the interventions that we can provide can prevent a more expensive problem. Homelessness is really expensive. The long-term effects of having a child living in a home where they're exposed to violence is really expensive. Families that have stable housing, have food on the table, are safe from violence, are much better positioned to hang on to their jobs, to help their kids have success in school. And because our clients are low-income people, they're generally putting money right back into the economy. They're paying rent, they're going to the grocery store, they're putting gas in the car. So making sure that low-income families can keep their housing, keep their jobs, keep their kids in school is really a profound boost to the community. So we certainly encourage you to think about civil legal aid as part of your housing relief strategy. I really appreciate, once again, the opportunity to speak with you, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Sarah. Are there any questions from members of the committee? I don't see any, Sarah, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
So those are the three presentations that we had scheduled for you this afternoon. On our agenda, we now have item four, which is open discussion. Are there any other issues that members of the committee would like to discuss today? Representative Walner.
I have a couple of things that I would just like to see if I could get some information about. And these are not about housing issues, but more about how we're going to keep track of the spending that we've been doing. And particularly, I have two issues particularly. Last week, the governor announced that he would be setting up a number of relief funds. I believe there was the Main Street Business Fund. There was a health care fund. There was the child care fund. So he's setting up a number of these. And I wanted to know how we will be able to track the spending in those different funds. How will we know, for instance, who gets the grants? What organizations or what businesses get grants? Will that be something that's kept track of at the Gopher office and then put on the Gopher website? Or how will the public know who's getting those grants?
Yes, the plan, representative, is to track all of the expenses through the Gopher office and to have a system, a back-end system created that will allow the data, the information about who received grants and how much to be posted very quickly on the Gopher website.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I do have one further question.
Certainly. Go ahead.
Okay. So back in mid-March, the governor set up the first fund. It was the health care relief fund. I think it was $50 million. We've had a lot of discussions about that. And some of those funds were taken from different accounts in the general fund. I know there were some funds taken from the secure psychiatric unit at New Hampshire Hospital. There were some funds that were taken from the Substance Abuse Fund and put into the special fund. Have those funds gone back since we now have the $1.25 billion? Have those funds been replaced in those Health and Human Service accounts?
I would have to check with this is Jerry Little. I would have to check with Department of Health and Human Services to determine whether or not the funds have actually been flowed back in exactly. I do know that basically general funds were replaced and backfilled with CARES Act funds once the CARES Act money was received. If you would like, I will reach out to HHS and ask if all of the lines were refreshed to their previous levels. But I will have to check with HHS to get that answer.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Lowe. I would appreciate getting that information. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome. Senator Susi.
I actually had...
I actually, thank you, Commissioner. I actually had two questions as well. One was regarding the Main Street Relief Fund that DRA is administering. And my understanding is pre-qualification application for folks. Is that information submitted confidential?
I don't know the answer to the question, so I will find that out for you.
Okay, that would be helpful. I've had a couple of inquiries whether or not the fact that somebody has applied or the information they submit, whether or not it would be subject to the right to know law. So that was one, and
yeah,
anything you could find out in that regard would be helpful. The second one was regarding, and I think it was a recent order, but the governor expanded the types of positions at long-term care facilities that would be eligible for the employee stipend. And I was just not able to find specifically who was that these stipends were being extended to.
Generally, the extension is given to anyone that is a client or customer or individual focusing an employee. But we are working on fleshing out that extension so we can provide you further details on that as well, Senator.
Perfect. That would be wonderful. Thank you.
So could I just go back to your first question?
Yes.
And I'd like to put it in the context of Representative Wallner's question, and I'm just curious what your preference would be. As I understand Representative Wallner's question, she wants to make sure that we're going to know everywhere that the money goes. And yours
mm-hmm.
is to make sure that the money, that the applications and use of the money is confidential. How would we reconcile the issues?
Well, I think it's the pre-qualification application, because no money is going out. It's whether or not there's the possibility for money going out in that instance. I mean, I do understand the expenditure might be subject to the right to know law, but whether or not someone is eligible is the question.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hennessy.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Little. I have two questions. One is I'm receiving a lot of questions from constituents on the Main Street funds around the self-employed little button that you have to press if you're self-employed. I think there's some confusion around what they're, how they've set up their business and whether they're self-employed or not. And I was wondering if you could have like a question and answer or frequently asked questions section in the Gopher on the web page there to help businesses fill out the form properly.
So are you asking us to help people determine if they are self-employed or not?
I guess that's what I'm asking you. I think some people are confused. I know that the governor said that self-employed businesses on his website, on his news conference on Friday, would not qualify because they are eligible for unemployment payments. I mean, but I don't know that that's true when for all self-employed businesses or not. So I think I'm seeking some clarification because some people consider them self-employed. But not only do they have home expenses, they have business expenses, rent, and costs for furniture and fixtures and employees and all of that. So I think that some of my constituents are seeking assistance on how to fill out the form and if they are self-employed, or maybe you could direct them to in some way to help fill out the form properly or if they actually are qualified for these funds.
Okay. We'll take a stab at that as well.
And I've received many questions on that. The other is on the business on the nonprofits that will qualify for the nonprofit funds. Chambers of Commerce have reached out to me and are hoping that although they were not eligible for PPP funds because they are 501c6s, they are hoping that they will be eligible for these nonprofits or for the Main Street funds because they are nonprofit businesses.
Very good. I believe that their specific situation is that they're 501c6s in particular.
Yes, I apologize. Did I not say that?
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, that's good. I will try to get some clarification on that from the governor's office.
Thank you.
Any further questions, comments, or issues to discuss? So I have a half dozen or so, seven questions that you'd like me to get back to you on, which we will do. I don't see any other hands up on the screen. That then leaves the last item on your agenda, which is your next scheduled meeting. We don't currently have one. I do know that you are all expecting to come back to Concord sometime in early June. Would you like to let me know when you would like to get back together, or how would you like to handle this? Representative Walmer?
I do have a question about when we'll have a discussion about the funding for the housing issues and whether or not we'll be making a recommendation about the housing issues to the governor.
I don't know the answer to the question. I think it will all depend upon when you're going to get back together again. But I do know that the Stakeholders Advisory Board is also working on this issue at the same time. Senator Morse?
Well, I think you just answered one of the questions. I don't think the stakeholder group has actually made their recommendations at all yet. And I'm not sure they're going to do it financially, like do it in millions and things like that. They were looking at a different way of doing it. But I think we should hear from them. But we did talk about the date of June 3rd of coming back and doing additional recommendations. And I think if the Speaker and the Senate President aren't going to schedule a session day that day, that's probably a good day for us to come back, considering the holiday hitting next week. So it probably makes sense to come back the week after that. And in between then, I think there'll probably be questions that we need to get answers to from the sounds of things today. So I think we could probably give that to the committee members and then come back on the 3rd and make more recommendations. In talking to you this morning, I believe there's about $400 million left in the account. So.
That's correct. The balance is roughly $400 million unallocated at the moment in the CARES Act Relief Fund. Any further comments? If not, we will pencil in June 3rd, or if you prefer, we'll put it in ink, unless we hear otherwise from the Senate President and the House Speaker.
Okay, thank you.
That date is fine.
Steve Sherlock, yeah, that date's fine.
Very good. Then we will put it in ink. Next meeting, 1 p.m. on June 3rd. And in the meantime, we'll get to work on those questions that you asked today and send out an email to you. Anyone else with a further question or comment? Are you all set, Speaker Shurtleff? Did we answer your question? Sounds like we must have. Very good. Then this meeting of the Governor's Office of Emergency Relief and Recovery Legislative Advisory Board, it will end at 2 p.m. Thank you all.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you.